This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
With music, games, prizes, and the classic movie Rear Window to the Clinton Street Theater, 100% of the proceeds will benefit KBOO. Visit kboo.fm for details. Kaboom! 2013 is KBOO's 45th anniversary. Huge celebration plans are underway that will totally rock Portland. We are seeking unique and wonderfully creative artwork for our commemorative t-shirts and posters. Email navigator@kboo.org if you are interested in donating your services and having your work associated with this historic event. A Navigator communications team is forming. If you are someone who can take direction, has initiative, good follow-through, and has excellent written and verbal communication skills, and you have 2 to 4 hours each week to contribute making calls, sending emails, and being part of a social media squad, attend a meeting Sunday, March 3rd at 1 p.m. at KBOO. Refreshments will be provided. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator@kboo.org. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor an evening with Scott Silber, speaking on Threat to Themselves and Others, Intervention on Corporate Addiction to Power, Before It's Too Late. He'll be in Portland on Sunday, February 17th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, at the corner of 12th and Salmon. Scott Silber is National Director of National Intervention, who are calling for a 28th constitutional amendment to eliminate corporate personhood. More information about Scott and the event can be found at kboo.fm/ScottSilber2013.
This is John Trudell. Suggesting that you listen to and support KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, because we live in a time when the corporate state empire is doing more and more to reduce the voice of the people and the people's access to information and knowledge over the airwaves. It's very important to our present, to our future, that we have access to a clear way to speak out to the communities. Support Community Radio. KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, state lawmakers hear testimony about the proposed Columbia River crossing.
Two U.S. House representatives announced their support of an amendment aimed at overturning Citizens United.
And a new report estimates that the U.S. annually loses $190 billion in revenue to offshore tax havens. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 11th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. This afternoon in Salem, the state legislature held a public hearing about the proposed new Interstate 5 bridge from Portland to Vancouver. The bridge project is known as the Columbia River Crossing and is projected to cost at least $4 billion. Opponents of the project say that according to some estimates, the bridge could cost up to $10 billion, with no guarantee of federal matching funds. One recent study of Oregon Department of Transportation highway projects found that most end up over budget. The largest current project, the Highway 20 Eddyville project, is expected to cost nearly $400 million, which is more than three times its original $110 million budget. It will also be completed 7 years behind schedule. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, as a supporter of the Columbia River Crossing project, was among the first to speak at the hearing.
Today you have before you a project that has been analyzed, criticized, downsized, and looked at from absolutely every angle. It's been looked at independently by our state treasurer, by legislators, by international and national experts, and ultimately has been approved by our local, state, and federal partners. We have a construction-ready project that will increase mobility, will reduce congestion, and improve the transportation of goods throughout the state of Oregon and indeed throughout the world. As you know, these bridges, the oldest of which was built almost a century ago, form one of the worst bottlenecks on any highway system in the United States. This is the last lift bridge on Interstate 5, and it essentially puts a stoplight on an interstate highway system that contributes to congestion and in the neighborhood of 400 wrecks a day. What's more, these bridges are not seismically sound. They are built on Douglas fir footings that is sunk in soil that is liquefiable and would render these bridges inoperable should we experience the kind of major seismic event that most experts tell us we should be prepared for. So the bottom line is these bridges need to be replaced with modern, multimodal, seismically sound spans if we're going to maintain the vitality of our trade-dependent economy and make good on the investments we're making today to try to ensure economic recovery and growth in the future. So we've been at this a long time. My hair actually had color back in that video. We've reached a point, I think, of opportunity, but also of some significant urgency. Today, at the federal government, all the way up to the White House, we have very strong support for this project. We have the support of the Oregon and Washington congressional delegations. We have the support of Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. We have the support of Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano. In short, we have the support of everyone who is essential on the federal side to make this project move forward if Oregon and Washington are willing to commit to this project by making a commitment of resources.
That was Governor John Kitzhaber speaking today in Salem. A coalition of community groups opposed to the new bridge, which would replace the current one running from Portland to Vancouver, Washington, went to the state capitol to voice their opposition. KBOO's Mike Kleffer spoke with Lisa Marie White with Bike Walk Vote as she prepared to leave Portland with a group of people headed to Salem to testify at the hearing.
We're also hoping that, you know, our governor, he represents us and he's done a wonderful job in the past, and we want to encourage him to stand with us again going forward. And in the past, he has 100% agreed with our position on this. There's a quote in 1997 from his State of the State where he specifically said, you know, we as Oregonians, we cannot pave our way into the future. We can't pave our way out of our congestion problems and out of our transportation issues. And we agree with him. We agree that that is not what Oregon stands for. That is not what is going to address our problems, and it's not financially feasible. And we're hoping that he will hear us. Tina Kotek also, who has been a proponent of the project, we're hoping that she's has a chance to hear from us and maybe change her mind a little bit and see the light. That's what we're hoping. Right now, the major assertions that they've made for the reasoning for this project and to justify the up to $10 billion price tag for the project, the biggest single expenditure for a project in Oregon's history, is number one, that it's going to help with congestion, that it's right now that freight traffic is having trouble getting through on the bridge, when in reality, the numbers behind it show that traffic has been decreasing over that bridge over time. And all we do really by expanding the highway there is push that congestion down into the Rose Quarter, which pushes congestion and all of the pollution that goes along with it further into Portland. Second reason that they've been pushing this project, or that they give justification for it, is seismic upgrades, that this bridge is at risk of collapsing at any moment. It's in horrible shape and it needs to be updated. In reality, there are more than 24 bridges under ODOT that are in worse condition than this bridge. So why is this our priority? We have other bridges that would be much more likely to collapse if there was a seismic, you know, event. It does not make sense for this bridge to be our priority. Other than that, they're saying that there needs to be, you know, a better way for people to get here from Vancouver, because Vancouver is only going to be growing over time, and we're going to have more and more trouble with people getting into Portland from Vancouver. Well, in response to that, we would say that, you know, a massive highway expansion is not the best way to get people through. And if it is, you're really just stopping the freight from getting through, which is their other argument. In reality, there are other options out there. One is a common sense alternative. We encourage people to look into that, the common sense alternative. And what we're saying is we don't know exactly, or we know that there are better options out there. And we want to make sure our legislators look at them, because the current project is, number one, still unbuildable. The height of the bridge is still in question. And number two, it's outrageously expensive. And we can't afford it as Oregonians. If we can barely afford to pave some of our roads, how can we afford an up to $10 billion mega highway project? It doesn't make sense.
That was Lisa Marie White with Bike Walk Vote, who went to Salem today to testify against the proposed Columbia River Crossing Bridge from Portland to Vancouver.
The pressure for universities to divest from fossil fuels is gaining momentum, with students from Cornell and Tufts officially calling on their schools to move their endowments out of the fossil fuel industry. The Tufts student government group that represents undergraduates to the administration passed a resolution this weekend calling on their board of trustees to immediately end any new divestments in fossil fuel companies and commit to full divestment within 5 years. At Cornell, the student assembly passed a similar resolution last Thursday, calling for a full divestment from the fossil fuel industry by 2020. With these two new resolutions, Cornell and Tufts have now joined over 200 student bodies at colleges across the nation, calling for their administrations to divest their endowments from fossil fuel companies. The movement originated with the International Climate Change Organization 350.org's Do the Math tour last fall. Do the Math encouraged students to mobilize and put pressure on their presidents and boards to divest from direct ownership that includes fossil fuel public equities and corporate bonds. Following 350.org's rallying call, students at Unity College of Maine and Hampshire College in Massachusetts successfully convinced their schools to fully divest from oil, coal, and gas companies last fall.
Victims of Hurricane Sandy are protesting President Obama's climate change plan. The protest was held today outside the White House. Activists unveiled a petition signed by 280,000 people, which opposed the expansion of the transcontinental Keystone XL pipeline. Keystone XL would carry oil extracted from Alberta, Canada's tar sands to Texas refineries. Climate scientists have warned that refining and burning the shale reserves located in Alberta's soil would catastrophically affect global climate change, making severe tropical thunderstorms like Sandy and events like the massive drought which hit the American Midwest this year more frequent and persistent. Hurricane Sandy killed 250 people worldwide and cost an estimated $74 billion in damage for the U.S. Newly appointed Secretary of State John Kerry stated over the weekend that the decision on whether to continue the construction would be made in the near term. In 2012, Obama approved a section of the pipeline spanning from Nebraska to Oklahoma, which joins an operational pipeline which runs from Alberta to refineries in Illinois.
A major snowstorm knocked out power in many parts of Connecticut and Massachusetts this weekend, dumping several feet of snow on the eastern seaboard. In Rockaway, Queens, New York, tens of thousands of people were hit by the storm while still trying to recover from Hurricane Sandy 3 months ago. To get an update on the relief effort, we spoke with Gordon Soderberg, no relation to KBOO's news director. He is part of the new group Friends of Rockaway, which was formed by local residents to help their neighbors recover from the storm.
Pretty much people are, you know, they got their power back on, most, not all. Most people have gotten their houses gutted, but not all. And I'd say about 95% has been gutted, but there's probably still 5% that still has stuff in their house that was there on Halloween. So as far as, the effect of the weather goes, it's pretty much slowed down a lot of the volunteer effort that we saw originally. But now we're getting into the point where we're doing more, the rebuilding and the stuff that needs certification to clean up the mold and that. And so there's a retraining effort going on to get Rockaway residents and volunteers trained up to do the mold abatement and eventually the reconstruction. 95% of the residents were affected in Rockaway, and 100% of the houses were damaged to one degree or another. And then there's plenty of apartment buildings where apartments weren't affected on upper floors, but they either didn't have power or their elevator was taken out by the storm. So it's been a long 3 months, but it's been a really encouraging one. Effort. Friends of Rockaways is a startup nonprofit made up of locals that wanted to help their neighbors rebuild. New York Cares is another organization we worked with, and they're helping out all over the community. We're both benefactors to the Robin Hood Foundation's grants to get homes rebuilt. So we're hiring actually local residents that are unemployed to get, and we're putting them through the OSHA training to get trained to be able to do this work, and we're employing local folks to actually get the work done. There's a lot of mitigating efforts that are going on that I think will help, but those houses that survived this one are still at risk for the next one, and there's plenty of those houses. I mean, 98%, I'm sure, of the houses are going to get rebuilt. So the ones right on the shoreline are the ones that took it in the teeth for everybody else, but everybody got affected one way or another.
That was Gordon Soderberg speaking from Rockaway, New York. For more information on the relief effort, go to their website at friendsofrockaway.org.
Three grand jury resistors are currently in their second straight month of solitary confinement. The three local activists are being held in Washington by federal law enforcement agents who hope that imprisoning them will coerce them to testify in a grand jury hearing. Unlike normal trials, grand juries are held in secret, and there is no defense allowed for those charged. In addition, people who receive a subpoena are required to testify and cannot claim Fifth Amendment protection. In this case, the grand jury is allegedly investigating graffiti on a federal building in Seattle at a protest last May. But the timeline of the investigation shows that the government surveillance of local anarchists began long before then. KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Chris of the Committee Against Political Repression about the current situation of the three witnesses that are in prison for refusing to testify at the grand jury.
What about the people who are being held in prison right now? Can you talk about why they're being held and what their conditions are?
Sure. So right now, Maddie Pfeiffer, Matt Duran, and KDO are all being held for their refusal to cooperate with the grand jury investigation. They've committed no crimes other than refusing to testify and give information. Right now, they're currently being held in administrative segregation, which is commonly referred to as solitary confinement. In these conditions, they are cut off from the general population of the prison and have about 1 hour a day that they get to get out of their cell. So we're just continually asking people to continue to send letters, books, expressions of appreciation, solidarity out to these three, who right now are still holding strong and still standing by their beliefs.
And just to be clear, none of these three are being charged with any crime.
Exactly. The only thing that they are facing right now, and the only reason why they're in prison, is because they were held in contempt of court, which is not an actual crime.
What is the legal justification then for requiring people to testify at a secret grand jury?
So the grand juries technically can only keep someone incarcerated so long as they believe that the incarceration is going to make the person testify at some later date. And that's what they call coercive incarceration. It's illegal for them to keep people held incarcerated punitively. And despite the number of times that the three people who are in prison right now have said that they have no inkling to be participating in this grand jury, they still remain to be held, which is a purely punitive measure. And they can be held as long as this grand jury continues to go, which at max can be 18 months. So there's a chance that they might be facing the remaining, I believe, 14 months in federal prison.
Well, it certainly seems that this long grand jury is exceeding the cost of any vandalism that might have occurred in May Day of last year.
Part of it is using this investigation and the consequences of it to try and scare people out of taking direct action. Part of it is to demonstrate what happens when people stand in solidarity with others by punishing people for refusing to cooperate in secretive grand juries. The government's attempting to make this a crushing defeat and break people's morale. But what we're seeing come from this is an increased wave of solidarity from anywhere from the support that people are giving the prisoners individually to different actions that are being held across the country and also in other countries across the world to show their solidarity with the Pacific Northwest grand jury resistors.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Chris of the Committee Against Political Repression. Their website, nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The United States Treasury Department announced today that it will fund a pilot program to help Multnomah County homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages. The program will allow the State Housing and Community Services Department to purchase troubled loans and refinance them at a lower interest rate. An estimated 11 million U.S. homeowners are underwater on their home loans, meaning that they owe more money than their home is actually worth. The new plan was advocated by Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley and is similar to the Federal Home Affordable Refinance Plan, or HARP. It does differ from HARP by allowing assets to be purchased that are not held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. $10 million from the Treasury's Hardest Hit Fund, an Obama administration project to aid the housing market in 18 states, will be used to start the new program. Homeowners who may qualify for the program can go to OregonHomeownerHelp.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. In today's show, we hear productions by students who took a radio class at a Portland juvenile detention facility. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be overcast throughout the day with a slight chance of showers, highs around 50 degrees. Tomorrow evening should see an increased likelihood of rain, lows near 46.
It is 5:24 in the evening, and time for our daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Since being thumped hard by voters last November, Republican leaders have gone through a period of reflection, introspection, and contemplation, and they now say they must make fundamental internal changes to become realistic political contenders. Does this mean they're finally going to quit being a political front for the Koch brothers' plutocratic fantasies? Jettison their Tea Party nuttiness about everything from nullification to legitimate rape? Or stop their destructive fixation on budget slashing? No, no, it's not their own deeply flawed fundamentals they intend to change, but the inner workings of America's election mechanics. The problem, they say, is not their unpopular policies or their offensive strategy of attacking whole swaths of the electorate, but that states are not allocating their electoral votes in ways that would throw the election to Republicans. For some time, we've seen GOP governors and election officials openly rigging rules and voting procedures to shut out students, minorities, seniors, and other likely Democratic voters from casting ballots. But now, Top Republicans are going all out to fix vote allocation rules in selected swing states, enabling their presidential candidates to, quote, win even though they lose. For example, last fall, Obama won Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. But with Republicans in control of those state governments, the GOP is scheming to award the electoral votes of those states in the future not to the statewide winner, but to the winner in each congressional district. If it had been fully implemented for last year's election, this arbitrary slicing and dicing would have diverted enough electoral votes to Romney to hand him the presidency. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more on the GOP's plot to steal the White House, see a full report at AmericanProgressAction.org. That's AmericanProgressAction.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
A new report outlines the ways offshore tax havens are blowing a huge hole in state and federal tax systems. It costs governments and small businesses massive amounts, including a $500 million annual hit to Oregon tax revenues. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Quinn Reed has more.
A new report estimates that $190 billion a year in revenue is lost to offshore tax havens. That's enough to stop the automatic federal spending cuts threatened for March 1st, and then some. Dan Smith wrote The Hidden Cost of Offshore Tax Havens for the watchdog group U.S. PIRG. He says they estimate the United States loses $150 billion a year, and states lose another $40 billion. In Oregon, Smith says the loss is estimated at $506 million a year.
It's not a victimless offense. The winners are the big banks, pharmaceuticals, and high-tech companies, and the losers are small businesses and ordinary taxpayers.
Defenders of the tax havens say they help firms dodge a high corporate income tax rate, and that companies might relocate if the loopholes were closed. But Smith argues that few companies pay the full corporate tax rate, and he says they're unlikely to leave the U.S. because the work is done here and the products are sold here. The report says 40% of the money in offshore accounts belongs to wealthy individuals, and 60% is corporate money. Smith says the corporate subsidiary is one type of tax dodge. Products might be created and sold in the States, but the profits can magically bounce around the world before ending up in a Caribbean P.O. box.
In the Cayman Islands, there's actually a single building, 5 stories tall, that has nearly 19,000 corporate headquarters registered to it.
And Smith says the system gives the biggest companies an unfair advantage.
The small business owner doesn't have 1,000 lawyers in its tax department. That's how many General Electric has. And not surprisingly, that company, over a 3-year period, paid nothing in federal income taxes.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Quinn Reed with KBOO News.
The movement to overturn Citizens United picked up speed this morning when 2 members of the U.S. House of Representatives announced their sponsorship of the We the People Amendment. Citizens United was the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision that said corporations have a First Amendment right to spend unlimited amounts to influence elections. The proposed amendment states that rights under the Constitution belong to people, not corporations, and that political campaign spending is not free speech protected under the First Amendment. Move to Amend is the nonprofit coalition dedicated to overturning Citizens United, and today KBOO reporter Quinn Reed spoke to Ben Mansky, a spokesperson for Move to Amend, about the proposed amendment.
Can you talk a little about the Move to Amend coalition?
The Move to Amend coalition is the nation's largest and most diverse coalition working to not only overturn Citizens United, but to amend the Constitution to deal with the problem of corporate domination of our government. Today we announced the introduction of the We the People Amendment in Congress. That is being sponsored by Representative Rick Nolan of Minnesota.
What specifically does the We the People Amendment call for?
The We the People Amendment squarely deals with the problem of corporate domination of our politics and of our society. There are 2 sections to the amendment. Section 1 makes clear that corporations may not be protected by the courts through this idea that corporations have constitutional rights. Section 2 makes clear that money is not speech for the purpose of elections. Through these 2 doctrines, the doctrine of corporate constitutional rights and the doctrine of money is speech, the federal courts have increasingly protected corporations against regulations enacted on behalf of we the people. And in such a situation, democracy cannot function if we cannot regulate our elections or our workplace conditions, because corporations have constitutional rights against those regulations, privacy rights, due process rights, First Amendment rights, then we can't enact laws in our own interest. We can't have a functioning democracy.
Now, how does this differ from other proposals that have come forward in response to Citizens United?
The amendment itself is different in that it is the only amendment that has been introduced that deals squarely with the problem of corporate constitutional rights and money is speech in the same language.
So what's the road ahead?
Our entire strategy is about building political power from below, engaging tens of millions of people in this movement, and creating a situation in which Congress cannot afford not to act on the We the People amendment. We think they'll want to avoid a constitutional convention. We think they'll prefer to pass the amendment onto the states for ratification. Move to Amend is very focused on building this movement from below at the grassroots. And so we have been organizing regional democracy convergences in different parts of the country. There will be a democracy convergence the first weekend of May in Portland, and I want to make sure that KBOO listeners know about that. They can go to movetoamend.org to find out more.
Why is it so important?
It's critical that we amend our Constitution, because if we fail to do that, then we allow our basic law to rest in the hands of unelected elites who live very far away from the rest of the American people. I'm speaking specifically of the federal judiciary. And the result of that has been that in decision after decision, when it has come down to a question of property versus people, or corporations versus people, the court has repeatedly sided come down on the side of power of the establishment of the major corporations. Everything that happens in our lives is impacted by the power of corporations. Corporations increasingly set the curriculum in our public schools. They're trying to take over our public schools, our correction systems, welfare, the military. Every part of our lives is subject to this corporate takeover, sometimes called corporatization. The way that we can undo that is by redefining what the corporation is, asserting that we the people are in charge, making democracy real. Without a functioning democracy,